You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of May 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme...
Je sais que les Françaises et les Français en cette heure attendent beaucoup de moi. J'en suis pleinement conscient. Vive la République, vive la France.
Emmanuel Macron says that the French public expect a lot from him, but what lies in store for the country's youngest leader since Napoleon? Also ahead...
He's a showboat, he's a grandstander. The FBI has been in turmoil, you know that, I know that, everybody knows that.
Donald Trump might not think much of James Comey, but did he tape private conversations with the former FBI director? We'll also be assessing North Korea's claim that its missiles are now capable of carrying a large nuclear warhead. And as companies assess the fallout from a massive criminal cyber hack, we'll discuss whether we could all do with being a bit more digitally aware. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Yes, a warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are John Everard, who is the UK's ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea, and Xenia Wickett, who's head of the US and Americas programme at Chatham House. A warm welcome both to the programme. Good to have you with us. Emmanuel Macron's first day as France's president would be the stuff of nightmares for many of us. The country's youngest leader since Napoleon has appointed a new prime minister. He's also met his German counterpart, Angela Merkel, in Berlin. So what have we made of him? John, I say a nightmare because... That is a busy in-tray with plenty to deal with. And I guess the first key stroke was to appoint Edouard Philippe as the Prime Minister. What do you make of that appointment? What does that hint to you, if anything, about where things could be headed for Macron?
Yes, a nightmare indeed. I mean, France is rapidly becoming the kind of country where mothers frighten their children by telling them that unless they behave, they'll end up as president. What I make of that appointment, I think it's as a lot of the French commentators have said, a clear indication that Macron is reaching out beyond his own party, which of course is new and very green, to more established political figures who are like-minded. And Edouard Philippe, in his acceptance speech, made clear that he got the right man, that he agreed with Macron on most things, came up with this wonderful line that he was Norman, that Normans are violently moderate, he said, but also very good at conquering things. So watch this space. The interesting thing to me is not so much the appointment he has made as the appointments he hasn't made. I mean, traditionally in France, unlike the United States, of course, the president appoints both the prime minister and all the other ministers in a matter of hours after he takes office. So everybody was expecting the appointment of the prime minister this morning in Paris and then a slew of other ministers this afternoon. But in fact, the prime minister was appointed in the afternoon and that was it. There'd be no further appointments. Why that is, maybe one day we'll find out. I suspect that Macron, having brought in a new prime minister, is consulting him over further appointments, which would be a good sign if true.
It would be. And could it be a sign, Xenia, of a kind of new, I don't know, or a much needed consensual politics in France? I mean, John's alluded to it already. He's explained it, Philippe. You know, the mayor of Le Havre was a sort of a Juppé acolyte before, who, of course, was runner-up in the race for the Republican nomination at the end of last year. That is reaching out across party boundaries. But does it sort of light a way for Macron? Can he continue in this vein?
It's a great question. I mean, you have to remember, you know, Macron's party, En Marche, didn't exist a year ago. You've got parliamentary elections coming up later this month, the beginning of June, I think it is. Unless he gets a parliamentary majority or can build a coalition in parliament, he's going to find it awfully hard to get anything done. So it's absolutely vital, even more than it is at any other time, that he is able to kind of bridge barriers, cross party lines, bring people together. That's why he created the party. I mean, he created the party to get away from the two-party system that that principally existed in France. He brought in an ideology that was in many respects a bit of the right and a bit of the left. What he's done with his appointment of the new prime minister, Edouard Philippe, is to reach out to the right. He is clearly trying to do that. The thing he is going to struggle with more than anything else is, you know, he has put out a very tough agenda as to what he wants to get done. He has said to the French people, you have high expectations for me and I am going to need to... So he's set the bar really very, very high, not just within France, but actually within the European Union itself, talking about reform of the EU. In order to do that, he is going to have to cross party lines. He is going to have to work across lines. He's clearly trying to do that. Will it be enough? I'm not so sure. I mean, a very different circumstance. This is what Trump's having to do and trying to do in the United States. And dare I say it, failing pretty dismally at the moment.
We'll come on to Trump in a minute. And we'll come also to this meeting with Merkel and these broader EU-wide questions. But I just wonder, John, on that point about the critical importance of these parliamentary elections in France, he has another issue, which is that he's putting candidates forward for almost all the seats. From where is he drawing these candidates? A very small number, I think only about 5% of were previously sitting MPs. And he draws in people, maybe, 50% of whom might have no political experience. You can see the logic, but it's an enormous political gamble, isn't it?
It is a big political gamble. It is bringing in fresh blood in a big way, to an extent that I don't think the French political establishment was really expecting. And if it pays off, I mean, it will be devastating. He may actually be the man who succeeds in fracturing the existing French political structures, which would be quite a legacy if it gets there. The $64,000 question, of course, sorry, €64,000 question, is whether or not he can actually sell this to the French electorate. The French electorate are, as we can see from the recent election results, that they're feeling bolshy. I mean, you can just have to trawl through some of the media comments there to get the buzz of dissatisfaction. I suspect that trying to convince people that this very large number of completely inexperienced new people are the best thing for France is going to be a hard sell. But to be honest, if anybody can do it, Macron can.
But I mean, he's also, I mean, if you look at some of the things that he's pledged to do in terms of the working week and in large part in terms of the working lifestyle, these go against the views of so much of the French population. I mean, he's going to find it, you know, I just want to back up what John was saying. He's going to find it extraordinarily hard to get some of these policies through, even if he can reach across the aisle, because they're almost the antithesis of what many people in France think is right in terms of the social safety net and things of that nature. This is going to be really, really tough for him to do.
And we have to remember that he got into power despite a huge number of abstentions and spoiled ballots. Mm-hmm. There's an awful lot of people who might naturally have voted for a centre-right candidate who are deeply uneasy at what Macron is proposing.
Just tell me, I'd be interested in what you both think about this. We talk all the time about, you know, this increased polarity in politics in Western Europe, in the United States as well, nationalism, aggressive rhetoric, all this kind of thing. And yet, there's been an investment of sorts from the French people in Macron, even if it's with reservations, as you rightly say, John. And now he's reaching out across political boundaries. He brings in a more conservative prime minister. One would imagine that his cabinet will follow similar lines. How come this narrative is catching on in France? It seems to be almost antithetical to what we see in other countries where the polarity increases all the time. John, why do you think? Is it just because people are desperate for change? Is there an appetite for anything but what's gone before? Why do you think Macron seems, only in early days, of course, to be able to sell this idea about coming back to the centre ground and maybe, you know, bringing in this more consensual approach?
I think there's a cocktail of reasons. I think partly is desperation. I mean, a lot of French people have just got this deep sense that things are not going well and that this might well be the time for a radical change. Partly, too, it is a reaction against the alternatives. A lot of people voted Macron because they did not want Marine Le Pen. And by extension, I suspect we'll be prepared to give Macron and the ministers he eventually appoints the benefit of the doubt, provided he pursues policies that they recognise being at least, you know, halfway sane and not Front National. And the other thing is that traditionally in France, the polarisations have been around between the right and the left. The left is in a state of collapse. Mm. I mean, the socialist vote in the elections was embarrassing. Hollande, of course, shrinking away as a political figure by the hour, and now, you know, finally out of office. So that on his left wing, at least, Macron was just staring into a void.
I would also characterise it slightly differently. that France is so different. I mean, I think you're seeing again and again and again across Europe, you're seeing it in the United States, a rejection of the traditional political parties. So it's not a question of people moving to the middle necessarily, although in this case I will agree that Macron does appear to be kind of centre ground. I think it is much more a phenomena of people rebelling against the options that they historically have had available to, and wanting something different. In France's case, it's somebody in the middle. In the case of the United States, on the Republican side, you know, you can make a strong argument that says Trump isn't further right, further conservative. That would have been Ted Cruz. He's actually more in the middle in some respects, but it's a rejection in the same way that Bernie Sanders was a rejection of what currently exists. You could argue that the same thing is happening here in the UK, which is, you know, on the left at least, there is a rejection of what we've had before. So this is, it's for me, it's much less a question of whether people are moving to the centre or moving to the extremes, and much more a question of, based on what came before, it is a rejection of that for something different.
I wonder. I think one of the hypotheses yet to be tested is just how far French people voted for Macron rather than Fillon because they believed in Macron, or rather because, although they probably agreed broadly with Fillon's political stance and what he stood for and his party, that, you know, these allegations of corruption were just too much to stomach, whether it was the wrong candidate at the wrong time, and whether, had these allegations not surfaced, that we might have Fillon rather Macron now in the Élysée.
Zen, just before we move on, I did want to briefly mention this meeting with Merkel. She'll be very happy that a committed EU president in the Élysée Palace. But what about exactly that sort of fear of the rejection? You know, he's got a reformist zeal. He's made clear that he would expect to try and extend that towards the European project as well. Do you think Merkel will be a little uneasy about that? Or?
We've already seen that to some extent. I mean, I think that I'm sure she is relieved that it's Macron rather than Le Pen that she's having to work with. You know, on one respect, and again, you also saw this and continue to see this, that there is a real sense, I think now, at least the media is relaying, that there's a real sense in Germany that, you know, there's a relief, there's another pole in Europe, and that Germany and France can work effectively together in kind of keeping strong the European project. On the other hand, if you listen to some of the things that Macron has suggested in terms of reforms for the EU, they go a lot further than Merkel wants to go. And so, you know, she's going to be in this kind of slightly push-pull, on the one hand having a strong partner to work with, and on the other hand trying to pull him back from some of his more extreme reforms, while she wants instead France to focus on its own internal system and its own kind of spending, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there will be a certain amount of tension, but I think right at the moment, I suspect there's just a lot of relief that that it's no longer Germany standing alone in the centre of Europe, but it's actually Germany and France again.
North Korea, let's move on. North Korea says that missile it tested yesterday was a new type of rocket that is capable of carrying a large nuclear warhead. Seoul says it's trying to verify the claim, but recent military tests have sparked international alarm and undoubtedly raised tensions with both the US and the South, of course. John, the latest claims, we've been charting this sort of to and fro and claim and counterclaim for, it seems like, years with you. Presumably, this is a very serious claim. We should treat it as such, and we should be a little more concerned than we were previously.
We should be a lot more concerned than we were previously. Whether or not this missile can in fact carry a large nuclear warhead, I think the jury's out on that. The point of that remark is that it's actually much easier to make a large warhead, we know that the North Koreans can do this, than to miniaturise and make a small one. So they are claiming effectively that they've dealt with that problem by building a missile large enough to carry the warhead rather than a warhead small enough to fit on the missile. Well, we'll see about that. What we have been able to observe is that this thing flew 2 kilometres high, 2,000 metres straight up and then straight down again, on what's called a lofted trajectory, which means effectively instead of pointing your missile the way that you'd normally point it if you're going to use it in an anger, you point it almost straight up and so on, if it goes straight up and straight down again. Had they pointed it toward the United States, it would have probably covered between 4,000 and 4,500 kilometres. That's a hefty range. That is enough to take out, for example, the American bases on Guam. Not quite the continental United States yet, but very close. More important still, although the experts are still arguing about this, it looks very much as if the North Koreans have actually mastered reentry technologies much sooner than people feared. For any listeners who don't have their own private long-range missile programs, one of the problems in developing these things is that although you can get them into the air and into space not easily, but the technology isn't so very advanced, getting your missile back again without it either spinning out of control or burning up is actually very difficult. Heat shield technology, gyroscope technology are extremely complex. And it looks as if, although the experts up until last week were saying that the North Koreans were years away from this, they've actually mastered these technologies already. This is getting scary.
It's getting scary, Zenia, and it's food for thought. And we've talked before about the Trump White House and maybe an absence of, I don't know, foreign policy nuance, I think it's safe to say. What do you imagine the mood would be there? This sort of news filters through. What kind of briefings would Trump get? And, you know, should we be worried that, you know, we may see more of these rash decisions that he seems to be prone to make?
So, I mean, let's put aside Trump for one second. I mean, I agree with John absolutely that this is something to be concerned about. This is something to have been concerned about for a long time. This is something that the Obama administration was concerned about. And, you know, Obama's message to Trump when he stepped down is, the first big challenge that you're really going to face is North Korea. This is something that prior to Obama, Bush was concerned about, and prior to Bush, Clinton was concerned about, and we go back. And every term, every 4 years, actually the challenge gets harder because North Korea gets that much closer to having all of the technology that it needs to really have full bandwidth nuclear capabilities, including to the United States and, I hasten to add, Europe, which we tend not to talk about quite so much. So, I mean, I think this was a real problem for Trump's predecessors. They did not have a good solution. I mean, there have been all sorts of iterations of the six-party talks and bilateral talks and sanctions and, you know, oil programs, you know, and none of them have lasted. And so, you know, as President Obama predicted when he stepped down, this is a real challenge for Donald Trump. Put on top of, and there were no good solutions any more than there were for his predecessors. And that's really worth mentioning. They're really, put aside what you may think about Trump, there are no good solutions to this because sanctions have not worked. And there's no real indication that America or anyone else is going to put enough pressure on China to put enough pressure on North Korea to actually make sanctions work, which is how it would have to work.
But on that point, that there's no good solutions, there never were. I mean, were there better chances? Were there the chances to mitigate this slightly? Could you point out an administration that maybe did, if not drop the ball, failed to push quite as far as they could?
Well, I mean, there's always been a question of taking that balance of, you know, once North Korea had the capability to use nuclear weapons, the whole equation changed. Prior to that, you had far more options. Post that, your options diminished considerably. You know, on top of that, of course, you've got, you know, a border with South Korea on the other side. And I think North Korea's got one of the biggest militaries in the world. I mean, particularly given as a percentage of its population, it is the biggest. But even on just raw numbers, whatever you do, North Korea will be able to attack South Korea. It will be able to attack Japan. It will be able to hit allies, however good and quick your response is as an American or as a European. So, I mean, there really aren't any good options, and there haven't been any really good options since North Korea gained the ability to use nuclear weapons. And then, and I'll just stop with this, that's before you even put the factor of Trump in. And so, and then you've got to put on top of that the fact of Trump. Now, you know, let me give you the kind of the positive view. You've kind of laid out the negative, which is he's rash, he's unpredictable. You know, could this lead to a, you know, really major crisis and in fact, a war on the Korean Peninsula? Absolutely. On the other hand, I remember talking to a former American ambassador to the negotiations with North Korea. And former foreign service officer. And he said, you know, North Koreans are the hardest negotiators because they're not quite rational in the way that we think of rationality. I mean, they're actually quite rational for themselves, but not they don't make decisions the way we make decisions because they're willing to take that much more pain. Well, North Korea now has a arguably not quite rational negotiator in Donald Trump. And that, well, on the one hand, is terrifying. On the other hand, maybe puts America in a slightly stronger negotiating position, not just with the North Koreans, but with the Chinese as well.
John, we'll come on to Trump in just a second and talk about his domestic woes. But just on this point, do you broadly agree with Xenia's reading of that? I mean, could it, in a strange way, his sort of lack of orthodox negotiating savvy play into US hands almost?
Yes, the uncertainty is an advantage in negotiations. Keeping your opponent or the other negotiating party guessing about your intentions, especially when the consequences of a misjudgment can be catastrophic, is a strong card to play. And a lot of observers had argued that the North Koreans, faced with this, were going to play safe. They hadn't, still haven't tested an ICBM. They haven't gone for a sixth nuclear test. But I think the latest missile test puts that into question. They've shown that even though they have not tested an ICBM, perhaps because they're not technically ready, perhaps because they believe that this really would put the cat among the pigeons, they have tested something very, very close to it. So that if the uncertainty of dealing with Donald Trump at the beginning laid a kind of calming hand on action of Pyongyang, sadly, I think that period may be over, and it looks as if they're just going to steam ahead. I agree with what Ian was saying. Everything's been tried. Victor Cha, the famous North Korean expert, has described North Korean policy as the land of lousy options. Everything sucks. And he's right. Sanctions, pressure, we tried the lot, and they're still doing these things. I mean, the great opportunity was right at the end of Bill Clinton's presidency, when he was all set up to go to North Korea, do the deal. And that might have changed the history of the peninsula since. Then Monica Lewinsky came along and he was distracted. Quite apart from other considerations, it's a huge opportunity lost on the Korean Peninsula. One of the life's great tragedies.
From one White House controversy to the latest, senior US lawmakers say Trump must turn over any recordings of conversations he may have had with his former FBI director. Trump fired James Comey last week. Comey's been investigating allegations of potential ties between Moscow and the Trump campaign. Xenia, it's interesting, isn't it? We don't have a Comey successor yet. Is that the job that nobody will want?
No, I think there'll be an awful lot of people who are lining up for that job. And we do have some kind of names out there in the ether, as it were. I think there are 10 or 11 candidates who are being considered, allegedly being considered. I mean, I think this is another one that I think we have to be really, really careful about how we interpret. On the one hand, Donald Trump fired Comey. Now, it is absolutely in the rights of a president to fire the FBI director. The only other firing of an FBI director was by Bill Clinton. There is no question that when Donald Trump says there was a lack of trust in Comey, that is true on both sides of the aisle. There really was, given what happened in the run-up to the election, there really was a lack of trust both on the Republican and the Democratic side for Comey. So, I mean, all of that is quite legitimate. The question we ought to be asking ourselves is not, should he or should he not have fired Comey? Because there's all sorts of very credible, reasonable arguments for why he should have fired Comey. The question we really should be asking ourselves is how he did it. I mean, that's what is so kind of distasteful, if you will. The fact that Comey found out by watching TV, the fact that the White House communications are saying one thing and Donald Trump saying another, the fact that, that there's an investigation going on with Russia, and there's all sorts of things that Donald Trump could have said and done to separate out that investigation from the firing of Comey. And in fact, if anything, he's done absolutely the opposite and say, oh yeah, absolutely, he was causing trouble, and was the Russia investigation a part of that? Yes, even though his communications team are saying no, absolutely not. I mean, that is the problem. Now, of course, we're in the situation where he has suggested that there might be tapes of the conversations that he'd had with Comey. I mean, my guess, and it really is a guess, is there are no tapes. But what was beginning to leak out is that Donald Trump had one interpretation of the conversations, and it was beginning to leak out that Comey had another interpretation of the conversations, and Donald Trump doesn't like that. And so, better make sure that there are no tapes. Threats. Can he back it up? Who knows? But this sounds exactly like the kind of thing that Donald Trump would say to kind of deter any further leaks from Comey's side about how it played out. Of course, now he's got himself in a totally different problem, because he didn't realise that both Democrats and Republicans alike would say, you've got tapes, we want to see those tapes. That's important.
It is important. And John, just briefly before we move on this, is this clearly a crisis in political presentation? The communications we know are definitely a weak point. But you've got the likes of James Clapper saying, well, hang on a minute, democratic institutions are under threat. Don't misquote me, Mr. President. Are we at that level, or do you think this is something that Trump can kind of, I don't know, can he paper over those cracks, do you think?
He's adept at papering over cracks, but I think cracks of this size, he's going to have a real struggle to paper over. It's not clear yet whether he realizes just how deep the water is that he's trying to swim in. Of course, you know, whichever way the tapes debate ends, he looks bad. Either he has, in fact, illicitly taped conversations to the White House, which, of course, is going to cause uproar, or he's got to look silly. You know, he's him talking about tapes that turns out don't exist. The Senate threatened to subpoena the tapes, which, you know, brings the whole thing into a legal arena and puts the president under so much more pressure. There's Clapper, not a known liberal. I mean, come on, you know, this is a dyed-in-the-wool sort of white Republican coming out and saying these things about a Republican president. Well, of course, a few draws to drop in Washington. I get the sense of, you know, a slow unraveling. Of course, we've also had Trump's declaration that there's going to be a great White House shaker. You know, people being sacked, people being moved on. It sounds as if even, you know, the rather modest team he's managed to assemble is about to crack open.
I just wanted to follow up one thing, because I think I probably sit in a slightly different place from where John does, which is, you know, what is amazing to me, not amazing, excuse me, what is interesting to me is that diehard Trump supporters don't care about any of this. This is irrelevant. This is just not resonant. None of this, whether it's, you know, even from missiles against Syria right through to you know, armadas going to North Korea, to the Pacific, to the tapes now and Comey sacking. Diehard Trump supporters just don't care. This is not resonating. It's irrelevant. It is only really resonating with the people who were already thought that Trump was an appalling president. And so I don't think that it's cracking yet, because actually you're not seeing people cross those lines that you'd need to see in order for there to be a real threat to Trump.
So not cracking, but maybe unravelling. I guess those two things don't necessarily contradict one another. Just before the end of the show, I did want to briefly mention this extraordinary criminal cyber attack spread across 150 countries. It does appear to be slowing, but employees around the world have been told to remain vigilant, which has prompted questions of how well equipped many organisations are to withstand this sort of attack. Do workforces know enough about their digital security? John, I'll come to you first of all. We're told, you know, you must patch security updates and so on and so forth. But is there a bit of a naivety that people would be well served to quickly address when it comes to how they engage with the complex IT and web arrangements they have in their office, at home and elsewhere?
Yes. I mean, there's naivety everywhere, as this cyber attack has massively demonstrated. One of the tragedies is that a simple update, and Microsoft apparently produced this thing in March, if uploaded correctly, blocks the cyber attack. The reason that it wasn't implemented in a lot of organizations appears to be simple lackadaisicalness. People just didn't get around to it. And I think this will be a bucket of cold water over the heads of a lot of IT managers and a wake-up call that you have to take this seriously. It's actually not that difficult to do the updates, but you have to do them.
And so, you know, on that point, you know, we look at businesses that have maybe felt out, but look at the NHS here. They have huge IT managers. They lavish hundreds of millions of pounds running these systems. How have they got into such a bind?
I think it's, I mean, this is, we're now, you know, perhaps starting to see the iceberg hit, as it were. I mean, we've been talking for, I was doing Homeland Security immediately post 9/11. So, I mean, you know, I'll date it back there. So it's 16 years odd that we've been talking about the cyber threat. And perhaps we were talking about it in smaller circles then, but certainly it's been fairly mainstream for the last 16 years. And yet, as the person on the street, for the most part, and the, you know, the small business, et cetera, they just aren't engaging. They're kind of, well, nobody's going to attack me. I'm innocent in this. And I think that what we're going to see over the next 5 or so years is you're going to see a ramp up of this kind of thing. I mean, what appears to be the case, although we don't know, is that, but certainly there are expectations, presumptions that this was not a state attack, state-led attack. This was a non-state attack, i.e. it was hackers, it was groups, it was individuals, etc., etc. That's extraordinarily hard to respond to. And so whether it's the NHS or whether it's, you know, your own personal computer, I think we are moving into a different age where this threat is paramount and we are going to have to take some serious steps, and we're just not doing it yet.
So be warned. Zeniel Kitt and John Everard, thank you both very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House. That's all we have time for on today's programme, which was produced by Rhys James and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Christian Radov. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. My thanks to them all. Do join us again at the same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London. Goodbye.